Welcome back to the podcast, everyone. Today, we're diving into a topic that I think will really challenge some of our preconceived notions about environmental health. We're talking about heavy metal exposure, but not in the way you might typically imagine.
Yeah, Adan, I think most people, myself included, usually associate heavy metal exposure with big industrial accidents, or maybe, you know, living right next to a factory, or that one time you ate a particularly dodgy tin of tuna. But what we're going to talk about today is far more intricate and honestly a bit more alarming in its ubiquity.
Exactly. The reality is, for most of us, this journey of exposure actually begins much, much earlier than we ever realize. We're talking about before we even take our first breath. It's a lifelong timeline where the sources of these metals, like lead, mercury, and cadmium, constantly evolve with our environment, our lifestyle, and our age.
Before birth? That's really eye-opening. I mean, you always hear about how important prenatal care is and avoiding certain things, but the idea that heavy metals are already a factor then, it's a lot to process. Tell us more about that, Adan.
It is, and it's quite profound. Many people are genuinely surprised to learn that the placenta isn't this impenetrable barrier we might imagine. It's incredible, but certain toxic metals can actually cross the placenta and enter the developing fetus. Others might accumulate in the placental tissues themselves, potentially influencing nutrient transport or even fetal development.
So, it's not just that the baby is getting a little bit of what mom gets, it's that the developing systems are just so sensitive to even small amounts?
Precisely. Modern research really highlights that prenatal exposure is one of the most sensitive periods of human development. Think about it. The nervous system, the endocrine system, the immune system, they're all forming at an incredibly rapid pace. Even a small amount of exposure during this critical window can have disproportionate effects later on.
That's pretty serious. What are some of the common ways a fetus might be exposed? I'm thinking of things beyond just obvious industrial pollution.
Well, some are quite common. For instance, maternal consumption of high mercury fish is a well-known one, which is why pregnant women are advised to choose lower mercury options while still getting the nutritional benefits of seafood. Then there's lead, which can be stored in the mother's bones from her previous lifetime exposures and released into the bloodstream during pregnancy and breastfeeding. It's like a time capsule of past exposures.
Wow, so even something that happened years ago can affect a pregnancy? That's wild.
Absolutely. Other sources include cigarette smoking or even passive smoke, which introduces cadmium. Contaminated drinking water, occupational exposure if the mother's job involves certain metals, polluted air, or even contaminated soil and household dust can all contribute. It's a complex web. The developing brain is particularly susceptible, even to tiny amounts.
Okay, so let's move past birth. What happens during infancy? I can imagine a baby's tiny body is just as, if not more, vulnerable.
You're spot on. The first year of life is a period of incredibly rapid brain growth. And an infant's body isn't just a miniature adult. Their liver, kidneys, GI tract, nervous system, they're all still developing. This makes them much more susceptible to certain environmental contaminants. Their bodies just aren't as efficient at processing or eliminating toxins yet.
That makes sense. So, what kind of exposures are we talking about for infants?
Well, a big one can be infant formula prepared with contaminated water if the water source isn't properly filtered or tested. Then there's contaminated household dust and, significantly, lead from old paint in homes. Secondhand cigarette smoke is another major culprit, as are some imported traditional remedies that might contain metals. Even some baby foods have been found to contain traces, and general environmental pollution, of course, plays a role.
It's like they're sponges, and I suppose the effects might not show up immediately, which makes it harder to connect the dots.
Exactly. Modern research continues to investigate how early life exposure can influence long-term neurological development, behavior, and cognitive function. The effects might not become apparent until years later, when a child starts school and experiences learning difficulties, for example. It's a huge area of active scientific investigation precisely because of that delayed manifestation.
That's actually quite scary for parents. Moving into childhood, I can only imagine a curious kid exploring everything with their hands and, let's be honest, often their mouths. That must open up a whole new set of pathways for exposure.
Absolutely, Aurora. Childhood is when curiosity truly meets environmental exposure. Kids are naturally explorers. They're crawling, playing in the dirt, putting things in their mouths. It's how they learn. But unfortunately, this behavior significantly increases their likelihood of exposure to contaminated dust and soil.
I can totally visualize that. My niece used to just pick up anything and taste it. So, what are the big ones for this age group?
Old lead-based paint and peeling paint chips are still major concerns, especially in older homes. Contaminated garden soil, particularly if there was historical use of leaded gasoline or old industrial activity nearby, is another. Renovation dust, if a home is being remodeled without proper precautions. And then there are imported goods. Certain toys, cosmetics, and even some spices have been found to contain lead or other heavy metals. And don't forget drinking water from old plumbing.
So much for everything is safe for kids with imported stuff. And lead paint, that's still a thing? I thought we got rid of that years ago.
The use of lead paint was banned decades ago, but it still exists in millions of older homes. The paint itself isn't a problem until it starts to chip, peel, or is disturbed during renovations. And children absorb lead more efficiently than adults do, plus their rapidly developing nervous system makes them uniquely vulnerable. The insidious part is that they may not show obvious symptoms initially. It might manifest later as learning difficulties, behavioral changes, or reduced attention span. That's why, really, no level of lead exposure is considered completely safe for children.
That's a really important point, no safe level. Okay, so we've gone from the womb, through infancy and childhood. What about the teenage years? You know, when they start making their own choices and exploring their independence.
Ah. The teenage years, a whole new frontier for exposure pathways. As kids become teenagers, new lifestyle choices and behaviors introduce different risks. For example, vaping products. Some studies have found heavy metals in the aerosols. Then, of course, there's cigarette smoking.
Oh, smoking, right. I remember hearing about cadmium in cigarettes. Is that still a major concern?
Absolutely. It deserves particular attention because tobacco plants naturally accumulate cadmium from the soil. So every single cigarette exposes the smoker to cadmium. Long-term smoking is one of the most significant non-occupational sources of cadmium exposure globally. And cadmium is tricky. It accumulates slowly, especially in the kidneys, and can stay in the body for decades.
Decades? So even if someone quit smoking in their 20s, that cadmium could still be affecting them in their 50s or 60s?
Precisely. It's a long-term commitment, unfortunately. Beyond smoking and vaping, teenagers might also be exposed through cosmetic products, hair dyes, or body piercings. Hobbies involving metals, like jewelry making or even sports like target shooting, can also introduce exposure to lead. And let's not forget dietary changes. They might start eating more processed foods or different types of fish.
It really does change with every stage, doesn't it? So, after the teenage years, we move into early adulthood. This is often when people enter the workforce. I'm guessing occupational exposure becomes a major factor here?
You got it, Aurora. For many, early adulthood marks the beginning of significant occupational exposure. Some jobs inherently carry a much higher risk. We're talking about professions like welding, battery manufacture, mining, demolition, construction, painting, electronics recycling, even dentistry, agriculture, metal fabrication, and laboratory work.
That's a pretty broad list. And it's not just the person in the job, right? I've heard of take-home exposure.
Absolutely. It's a critical point. Occupational exposure doesn't just affect the worker. Dust, particles, or residues carried home on clothing, boots, hair, or tools can expose partners and children. This take-home exposure is a serious concern. That's why good workplace hygiene, appropriate protective equipment, and changing clothes before returning home are so vital in these industries.
That's a really important message, not just for the workers themselves, but for their families too. Okay, so then many of these young adults eventually become parents themselves. I imagine this brings a whole new level of awareness and concern about exposure, especially for their kids.
It absolutely does. Becoming a parent is often a huge turning point where priorities shift. Suddenly, people start scrutinizing things they might never have considered before. The quality of their drinking water, the ingredients in baby foods, the safety of their cookware, the implications of home renovations, the dust accumulating in their house, the soil in their garden, and of course, their seafood choices again.
Yeah, I can relate to that. When you're responsible for a little human, everything suddenly feels like a potential risk. So, what are some of the key takeaways for parents trying to minimize exposure for the next generation?
It's all about simple preventive measures, honestly. Things like wet mopping instead of dry sweeping to capture dust effectively. Washing hands before meals, especially for kids who are always touching things. Using appropriate water filtration if your local water quality suggests it, or if you have an older home with questionable plumbing. And of course, following local guidance on fish consumption, choosing lower mercury options. The goal is to reduce unnecessary exposure without getting completely overwhelmed by fear, which is easy to do when you're a new parent.
That's a great distinction, reducing exposure without creating unnecessary fear. It's about being informed and taking practical steps. So as we move into midlife, say our 40s and 50s, how does the picture of heavy metal exposure change?
This is where the concept of cumulative exposure really becomes central. Unlike, say, an infectious disease that you either get or don't, heavy metal exposure is often a slow, steady accumulation over years. Someone exposed to small amounts repeatedly over many years may eventually have a greater body burden than someone exposed briefly to a larger amount. The body remembers these exposures, even if we've forgotten them.
So it's like a slow drip, drip, drip over time that eventually fills the bucket, so to speak?
Exactly. During middle age, healthcare professionals might start reviewing a patient's entire lifetime exposure history. This includes previous occupations, hobbies, smoking history, seafood consumption patterns, any home renovations they've done, the age of their plumbing, medications they've taken, travel history, and other environmental exposures. Because, as we mentioned, lead can remain stored in bone for decades, cadmium accumulates primarily in the kidneys, and mercury behaves differently depending on its chemical form. But all three illustrate how past exposure can continue to impact health.
It sounds like a detective story, piecing together someone's entire life just to understand their current health. So, what about older adults then? Does the body's natural aging process change how it handles these stored metals?
Yes, it absolutely does. Later in life, physiological changes can significantly alter toxic metal dynamics. For instance, bone turnover naturally increases with aging, and even more so with osteoporosis or menopause. This means lead that has been stored in bone for decades can be released back into the bloodstream during periods of increased bone remodeling. It's like the body's own vault for lead starts to open up.
So the very bones that kept it locked away can then release it when the body needs those minerals? That's quite a twist.
A significant one. Older adults may also experience declining kidney function, which affects their ability to excrete certain metals. They might be on multiple medications, which can interact or put additional strain on detoxification pathways. Plus, they have decades of previous occupational and cumulative environmental exposure already built up. And if they're managing chronic diseases, closer monitoring becomes even more crucial.
So even in retirement, that comprehensive environmental history you mentioned earlier is still highly relevant. It's not just about what you're doing now, but everything you've ever done.
Precisely. And this really brings us to a key point. No two exposure timelines are identical. Your neighbor might live right next door, but your lifetime exposures could be vastly different because of your occupation, smoking history, diet, hobbies, drinking water source, the age of your home, travel, cultural practices, or previous residences. It's truly personal.
That makes sense. You can't just assume what someone's been exposed to based on their symptoms or where they live. You really need to dig into their story.
Exactly. That's why practitioners should never assume exposure based on symptoms alone. A structured exposure history often provides more valuable information than any single laboratory result. It's the whole picture that matters.
So, it sounds like understanding this timeline isn't just about identifying problems, but about opportunities for prevention, right? Because if it's a lifelong journey, there must be points where we can intervene.
Absolutely, Aurora. And this is the encouraging news. Many sources of heavy metal exposure are actually modifiable. We're not powerless here. Simple, practical strategies can make a huge difference, like choosing seafood wisely rather than avoiding it altogether. This means opting for lower mercury fish while still getting those incredible nutritional benefits.
Right, so it's not about cutting things out completely, but making smarter choices. What else?
Avoiding cigarette smoking, obviously, given the cadmium content we discussed. If you're doing home renovations, especially in older homes, reducing exposure to renovation dust is critical. That means proper containment, ventilation, and cleanup. For those with private well water, testing it where appropriate is a must. And, if you're in a high-risk occupation, following occupational safety recommendations and using appropriate personal protective equipment is non-negotiable.
So, a lot of it comes down to awareness and vigilance in our daily lives and workplaces.
Precisely. Maintaining good household hygiene, checking imported cosmetics, spices, and traditional remedies for potential contaminants. These are all practical steps. The core idea is that reducing exposure at the source is almost always preferable to trying to remove accumulated contaminants later. Prevention truly is better than remediation.
That's a powerful message, And for healthcare practitioners listening, it sounds like environmental medicine really starts with a deep dive into a patient's life story, rather than just running a few tests.
You've hit on the essence of it. For healthcare practitioners, environmental medicine really begins with one simple question: where might this patient have been exposed? And the answer, as we've explored, rarely comes from a laboratory test alone. It comes from understanding the patient's entire life story. Environmental toxicology isn't just about identifying toxic metals. It's about understanding the intricate interaction between a person's environment, their occupation, their nutrition, their lifestyle, their age, and their unique biology.
So, when viewed through this lifetime perspective, the patient's history becomes their most powerful diagnostic tool. That's a profound thought, Adan.
It truly is. So as we wrap up today, I hope we've managed to reframe how you think about heavy metal exposure. It's not a single event. It is, in fact, a lifelong journey. From the moment of conception right through to old age, our environment constantly shapes the chemical landscape within which our bodies function. But the good news is, with this awareness, we can make informed decisions to reduce unnecessary exposure without feeling completely overwhelmed by fear.
Right, it's not about living in a sterile, impossible world. It's about understanding where the greatest risks are, minimizing those avoidable exposures, and supporting our body's natural resilience through sound nutrition, informed choices, and appropriate medical guidance when it's needed. Every stage of life presents opportunities for healthier decisions.
Exactly. The most important timeline isn't just measured by years, but by those opportunities at every stage to make healthier choices. Thanks for joining us today, Aurora, and thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to this crucial conversation.
It was a truly insightful discussion, Adan. Stay informed, stay healthy, and we'll catch you next time.